This is VOA News via remote. I'm Tommy McNeil. Deadly West Coast wildfires continue to divide President Donald Trump and the state's Democratic leaders for how to prevent blazes from becoming more frequent and destructive. Scientists say it's not as simple as blaming either climate change or the way it is managed. The governors of California, Oregon, and Washington state have all said global warming is priming forests for wildfires as they become hotter and drier. During a visit Monday to California, Mr. Trump pointed to how states manage forests. While experts say thinning trees and brush can help prevent fire threats, it's expensive and it's difficult to do the work as climate change dries out vegetation and more people move closer to areas that burn. Hurricane Sally is slowly closing in on the northern Gulf Coast, with powerful winds and weather forecasters are warning of potentially historic flooding. Hurricane warnings stretched from Louisiana to Florida and Alabama Monday. The governor, Kay Ivey, asked for a federal emergency declaration as the Weather Service warned of a storm surge of more than 9 feet in the Mobile area. The storm reached Category 2 strength and with sustained winds of 100 miles per hour Monday afternoon. Meanwhile, Hurricane Paulette knocked out power lines in much of Bermuda on Monday, but eventually appeared to have caused only limited damage, even as swells reached as far as the east coast of the United States. The storm lingered over the British territory longer than initially forecast by the Bermuda Weather Service. The U.S. National Hurricane Center said swells were reaching parts of the Leeward Islands, the Greater Antilles, the Bahamas, Bermuda, and the east coast of the United States, as far east of the United States. This is VOA News. China's finance ministry said Tuesday that it will extend existing tariff exemptions for 16 products from the United States, including lubricants, whey, and fish meal, by an additional year. The products received exemptions from retaliatory tariffs imposed by China on U.S. goods as countermeasures to U.S. Section 301 action in 2019. The ministry said the extension will last through September 16, 2021. This comes as the Trump administration Monday said it will block U.S. imports of cotton, clothing, and other products from five specific entities in Western China's Xinjiang region. Department of Homeland Security Acting Deputy Secretary Kenneth Cuccinelli says the move is aimed at combating China's use of forced labor by detained Uyghur Muslims in Xinjiang. He said the administration was conducting more legal analysis of the region-wide import bans. South Korea's prime minister told a cabinet meeting Tuesday that the country will secure early supply of coronavirus vaccines for international organizations and overseas drug makers for 30 million people, or 60% of its population. Globally, there are more than 926,000 COVID-19-related deaths and more than 29.1 million infections. Eight former commanders of Colombia's demobilized FARC guerrillas on Monday asked for forgiveness for kidnappings committed by the rebel group during the country's armed conflict and said they regretted the grave error. It is the first time since November 2016's peace deal between the government and the demobilized Revolutionary Armed Forces of Colombia that a group of former commanders, including former leader Rodrigo Ladano, have asked for forgiveness and accepted that they have made mistakes. Colombia's government and human rights groups accused the demobilized guerrillas of having kidnapped thousands of civilians and members of the armed forces during the rebels' part in more than a 50-year conflict that has led to 260,000 dead and millions displaced. An international team of astronomers Monday announced the discovery of a rare gas molecule, that's phosphine, in the clouds of Venus. It may be the first real evidence in the solar system of life beyond Earth. The team, which includes scientists from Britain, Japan, and the USA, on Earth, phosphine is only made industrial by microbes that thrive in oxygen-free environments. The team estimates the phosphine exists in Venus's clouds in only small concentrations. Via remote, I'm Tommy McNeil, VOA News.
Welcome to Daybreak Africa from the Voice of America. I'm James Butte in Washington. Today is Tuesday, September 15th, and here are some of the stories we are covering. Tanzania's main opposition candidate challenges President Magufuli to a debate.
Tanzanians will be happy to see or to compare the competencies of the two candidates in terms of self-expression, in terms of tackling important national and international issues.
Malawi police arrest a former information minister for alleged corruption. Sierra Leone's anti-corruption commission is concerned about alleged corruption in parliament. The prime minister of Eastern Libya's government has resigned following protests. And Uganda's first and current female speaker of parliament sees some gains for women participation.
The participation of women has changed over time, and I'm glad to say that in the recent primary election, a lot more members took an interest, and I see the representation changing.
And Kenyan healthcare workers say treating COVID-19 patients is taking a toll on their mental state. Those stories and more are coming up on Daybreak Africa. Presidential candidate for Tanzania's main opposition Chadema Party has challenged incumbent President John Magufuli to a televised debate ahead of the October 28th general election. Tundu Lissu, a former parliamentarian and former president of the Tanganyika Law Society, says a televised debate with the president will be healthy for the country's burgeoning democracy. President Magufuli and his governing Chama cha Mapinduzi CCM party have yet to respond to Lissu's debate challenge. Faraja Lugome is a lecturer at the University of Dar es Salaam. He tells VOA's Peter Clotty that it appears unlikely that President Magufuli will agree to debate Mr. Lissu.
I think it won't happen on the side of the candidate from the ruling party, because the same attempts were done in 2015, but the candidate from the ruling party avoided the debate. And even the supporters from the ruling party did not support that idea. And the reason is there is a poor preparation on the side of the ruling party, especially when it comes to public dialogues with the opposition. They have the advantage that they will always conduct some researches, so they are backed by information and researches. As a result, the ruling party will always be afraid of the change of the public towards their candidate.
But Faraja, do you think Tanzanians will accept the fact that the ruling party perhaps might not be interested in putting incumbent President Magufuli in front of Tundu Lissu for a debate?
Tanzanians will be happy to see or to compare the competencies of the two candidates, because it happened also in 1995 when the late President Benjamin Mkapa had the debate with the other candidates. It was a very good opportunity for the Tanzanians to gauge the capacity of their candidates in terms of self-expression, in terms of tackling important national and international issues that are related to the country. So the decisions for us in the ballot box will be determined also, will be contributed by how much these candidates have tackled some of the questions that will be raised to them during the debate.
Some Tanzanians are saying it will not be in the interest of the CCM to put President Magufuli in front of Tundu Lissu for a national debate like this. However, some are also saying that there should be an institution that should pressure and demand for this debate among all the prominent presidential candidates before the election. Do you see this happening?
To me, yes, the wishes of the people are genuine, but to me, I don't think if that will happen. Because, first of all, the freedom of speech in Tanzania is more limited, because there are no independent organizations now that can be able to put pressures on the organization of the national debate that will involve the two candidates. And as you have already highlighted or hinted before, the candidate from the ruling party is not very much eloquent in the sense that can be competitive when you compare with Tundu Lissu, who is used to the debates, who is used to analytical thinking, and also who is used to open criticism compared to the incumbent president, who most of us think is not ready to be challenged.
Faraja Lugome is a lecturer at the University of Dar es Salaam. He spoke with VOA's Peter Clotty. The first and current female speaker of Uganda's parliament, Rebecca Kadaga, says a lot has changed for women since she became speaker 9 years ago. She says the visibility of women members of parliament has resulted to more women leadership of committees. Kadaga also says she has brought parliament closer to the people and established the first workplace daycare center in Uganda. She also says overall women participation in Ugandan politics has seen an increase over the years, particularly during last month's ruling National Resistance Movement NRM primary elections. However, Kadaga says there are impediments to women participation in politics, including lack of campaign funding, social attitudes, and balancing politics and home life.
First, we have changed the face and visibility of the women members of parliament. As I speak now, 42% of the chairs of the committees are women. This was not the position before I took office. We have also ensured that the public is close to the population. We have introduced an annual parliamentary week where the people come to parliament to study, to understand, and to see what happens in parliament. I've also established the first daycare center in Uganda at our workplace, and this has been taken up by the other government agencies. It's now government policy that there must be daycare centers in places of employment.
Madam Speaker, what is your view about the level of women participation in Ugandan politics?
The participation of women has changed over time, and I'm glad to say that in the recent primary election, a lot more members took an interest, and I see the representation changing. At the general elections next year, I hope to see a lot more women come in. One of the other things we've done as a House is to, at the lower level, make it possible for women to represent only one sub-county. In the past, I've been representing 2-3 sub-counties vis-a-vis one sub-county for the men. So now, starting with this election, they will only represent one sub-county. So that has been a support to ensure that they are not overloaded with a lot of responsibilities.
What do you see as some of the impediments to women participation in Ugandan politics?
Now, some of the impediments really are to do with funding for the campaigns. Campaigns are very expensive. Others are to do with violence and social attitudes. But of course, politics takes time out of one's schedule. So it's one has to balance the work life as well as the political life, as well as the family life, because women have a lot of responsibilities.
Next year is general election in Uganda, and I understand that Ms. Salamu Musamba of the Opposition Forum for Democratic Change, the FDC, has expressed her intention to challenge your seat in parliament. Are you prepared for this challenge?
What I can say about that is that the elections last week must have shown everybody in the country how strong I am in the constituency. So I'm prepared for anyone to come. I'm not worried about anybody.
What is your view, Madam Speaker, about the Ugandan Electoral Commission's decision to ban open public political rallies ahead of the 2021 general election, instead mandating virtual campaigning?
I don't know whether it's really the Electoral Commission that has banned the rallies. I think we are all clear, but we have a pandemic in the country, and that congestion can cause a lot of problems. Public rallies attract a lot of people. So there is a limitation on the number of people one can address. So it's a difficult choice. One, as a country, we have to fulfill the constitutional mandate to elect our leaders every 5 years. And at the same time, we need to do it in such a way that we don't endanger the population.
Rebecca Kadaga is the first and current female speaker of Uganda's parliament. She was speaking with us from the capital, Kampala. The prime minister of Eastern Libya's government has resigned following protests in several Eastern Libyan towns and cities, including an attack on the headquarters of military commander General Khalifa Haftar over the weekend. Edward Uranian reports from Cairo.
المكتب الإعلامي لمجلس النواب أوضح أن الاجتماع جاء للوقوف.
A spokesman for Eastern Libya's interim prime minister Abdullah Al-Thani said he submitted his resignation to Parliament Speaker Aguila Sala, whose spokesman confirmed the resignation and indicated that it would be debated by MPs at a future session. The resignation came after popular protests in Benghazi and several other eastern Libyan cities over deteriorating living conditions, including long power cuts, water shortages, and a dearth of basic necessities. Libyan media with ties to Islamist militias showed video of what appeared to be a shooting in front of Eastern Libyan military commander Khalifa Haftar's main headquarters in the town of Al-Marj. Some Libyan media claim that protesters stormed the compound. VOA could not independently confirm the claim. Haftar's spokesman, Colonel Ahmed Al-Masmari, told Libyan TV that his forces support popular protests but urge protesters to demonstrate during the daytime so that they can be protected. Al-Masmari claimed that forces aligned with the Muslim Brotherhood and Takfiri groups were trying to sow chaos. The UN support mission in Libya issued a statement Sunday expressing grave concern over reports that one civilian was killed, three others wounded, and a number arrested after Eastern Libyan forces used what it called excessive force against peaceful protesters. Popular protests against the UN-backed Government of National Accord in the capital of Tripoli reportedly left several people wounded earlier this month after forces there fired on crowds. Libya has been effectively split between rival Eastern and Western governments since 2015. In other developments, Eastern Libyan military spokesman Al-Masmari told Arab media that reports that Haftar promised U.S. Ambassador to Libya Richard Norland that he would turn on the oil spigots again are being discussed and are tied to concerns that the government in Tripoli may use its share of oil money to pay for deals signed with Turkey. Libyan analyst Aya Berwaila, a visiting lecturer at the Hellenic Defense College, tells VOA that the crisis in eastern Libya can be blamed mostly on a budget shortfall, but that the interim government's resignation comes as a surprise to Libyans in that it shows it is responsive to its constituents and willing to take responsibility for its failures. Edward Uranian for VOA News, Cairo.
You are listening to Daybreak Africa on the Voice of America. I'm James Barty in Washington. Today is Tuesday, September 15. Malawi police have arrested a former information minister for allegedly stealing computers and generators that were meant for a state-owned news agency. The arrest is the latest since President Lazarus Chakwera came to power, promising to eradicate corruption under former President Peter Mutharika. Lamek Masina reports from Blantyre.
The arrest Monday of Minister of Information Henry Musa came a day after police arrested the former Director of Information Gideon Muntali in connection to the stolen items. James Kadadzera is the national spokesperson for the Malawi Police Service.
We do suspect that the items went missing last year, that the 2019, so in our custody and in court, as I'm talking to you, serving charges on abuse of office as well as theft by public servant.
A total of 10 people have been arrested for alleged acts of corruption during the Mutharika administration. However, critics question the time taken to carry out these latest arrests. Also, supporters of the former governing Democratic Progressive Party view the arrests as political persecution. But Kadadzera says the delays in making the arrests are largely because of lengthy investigation into the matter.
In fact, it's a question of evidence. So we were tipped on the thing, and we picked it up from there and instituted investigation. So these investigations have led us to the arrest of these two suspects. That's why we have made these arrests now.
Police say the stolen computers were donated by Malawi Communications Regulatory Authority and meant for state-owned Malawi news agency. In the meantime, police say one of the 10 stolen computers has been recovered from Muntali's house, while one of the 3 generator sets has been recovered from Musa's house. Lamek Masina for VOA News, Blantyre.
Sierra Leone's Anti-Corruption Commission says it is concerned about public sentiments regarding alleged corruption in Parliament. In a 2019 perception survey report released in April this year by the Public Financial Management Consortium, respondents said Parliament is the 4th most corrupt institution in Sierra Leone and that members of Parliament were the 2nd most corrupt. Commission Chair Francis Kaifala says the commission has begun an investigation into the allegations. He says the commission has called on all individuals who either paid bribes to or have been solicited by a member or members of parliament to come forward with such information in person or anonymously.
Firstly, we have been following what is happening in Parliament for long. In fact, we have a major investigations into the general financial dealings of the Sierra Leone Parliament that have been going on for about 6 months now, and we are about to conclude that. But recently, there was a report that said that the public perception itself says that Parliament is the 4th most corrupt institution in Sierra Leone, but also it says that parliamentarians are the 2nd most corrupt persons in Sierra Leone. So that places them very high up there. And considering their institution, how important they are to the democratic process in Sierra Leone, and generally why it is necessary for them to do their work with integrity, it drew our attention. And a whistleblower had also declared on BBC, on the radio, that there was corruption in Parliament, and he himself is a parliamentarian. Therefore, we came in to investigate, and we invited that person to speak to him, and we are looking into the issue.
It seems that you are asking the public to give you information of any corruption in Parliament. Does it normally work this way?
Yes, the claim by the Honorable who is that the process, their processes in Parliament, he said that each of these processes, people are being extorted of money, people are being asked to bribe parliamentarians, and that is when it comes to committee on appointments, they are paid. When it comes to legislative deliberations, they are paid. When it comes to budget hearings and approvals, they are paid. And generally, when it comes to the conduct of Parliament in terms of oversight and review of institutions, MDAs, they are also paid. So we invited this Honorable to speak to us, and he came in on Friday. Unfortunately, what he said continued to be general claims that, oh yes, there is corruption in Parliament, but they are done covertly. But he did not give us any specifics, any details. But considering the level of public interest in this issue, the way the public has reacted to it, it has put on us a huge expectation to deliver, to be able to get to the bottom of this. So since what this parliamentarian provided with us, and we are grateful for it, but since it did not give us that kind of specific lead that will tell us who, what, when, where, why, to help us answer some of the questions that the public will need, and for us to be able to do a professional investigation into the issue, we have now called on the public. For anybody who has information, have you been extorted before? Have people asked you for money in Parliament? Who did you pay to? How? What is their modus operandi? These are the things we are trying to look into, and we are enlisting the help of the public to be able to achieve this.
As you know, Mr. Chairman, members of Parliament have clout in the society, especially when they are connected with the ruling party. Now, do you have any protection for any whistleblower, someone who might come up and say they have information?
Yeah, we have advanced systems to protect witnesses. You can either report anonymously, as long as you give us meaningful information, we will not need to expose your identity. We can also put you into a witness protection system where possible. And more generally, we can give you protection. The laws provide guarantees. For example, nobody can do anything to harm you in your public space, in your workspace. If that happens, you can report to us and we can charge that person to court, as long as there is confirmation that that person is retaliating on you because you are assisting the commission. So those laws are all there, the guarantees are there in the Anti-Corruption Act, and we are trying to see how we can keep protecting members of the public as we do our work, because we rely on them to support us in our work. Without the public supporting our work, we will not be able to succeed.
You said your commission is investigating allegations of corruption involving, I think that's the clerk of parliament, What are you investigating him for or her?
There was another investigation which involves general administrative actions with respect to finances of parliament. And there was an allegation which also played out on public radio, where the clerk of parliament and another parliamentarian accused themselves of being corrupt. That issue is being investigated, and one of the key people who are assisting with that investigation is the clerk of parliament, whether or not, because it concerns allocations to parliament, how they were being handled and used. So we are looking into it to see whether they were not corruptly applied, whether they were not misappropriated, whether otherwise they were not applied in a way that was not proper. That is what we have been investigating. But that is different from this new one. This new one is an allegation of receiving payments for approvals of public appointees into public offices, legislative processes, and of course, oversight work of parliament.
Francis Ben Kaifala is Sierra Leone's Anti-Corruption Commission Chief. You are speaking with us from the capital of Freetown. Kenyan healthcare workers treating COVID-19 patients said the work is taking a toll on their mental state, forcing some in depression and therapy. Medics have been attending counseling sessions to help overcome the stress and psychological trauma that comes with fighting the illness caused by the virus. Mohammed Yusuf reports from Nairobi.
John Moisho here is one of thousands of Kenyan medical workers treating COVID-19 patients. The stress of the pandemic has been bearing down on him, and in late July, he also tested positive for the coronavirus, which causes the COVID-19 disease.
As a human being also, I'm also thinking aloud that I'm positive for COVID. What will happen next? What if death comes? And it's not easy. It is really a traumatizing state, and especially being out there. You cannot tell people because you don't know how people will take it.
The father of two is one or more than 700 Kenyan medical workers to test positive for the respiratory ailment. Moisho here, a trained psychologist, he says he was so upset by the diagnosis, he had to seek counseling himself. He wasn't alone. On an August weekend, 50 doctors from Tigoni Hospital Treatment Center attended mental wellness counseling sessions in Nairobi. Mary Waweru was one of them. Waweru says she had to seek help after avoiding her family for months due to her work.
I saw myself as a virus. I will go infect my children, infect my husband, and even my mom and dad. So I detached completely. So there was one time my daughter waited for me. At night, that day I got home at 11 p.m. So the question she asked me is, "Mom, kwani squeezy how to pendi?" So, "Mom, don't you love us anymore?" That was at 11 p.m. So that was my punchline.
Simon Njuguna, a public health officer, says he forgot about his mental needs.
We have been going through a lot. The schedules have changed. We have been very busy, and so having a day off, where you're having fun, forgetting there's COVID, it was very, 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 very rejuvenating.
Jerry Njuguna is a clinician at the Tigoni COVID Center.
I feel a bit lighter. I feel like I'm very relieved. I feel like I have now gained the strength to continue with my daily duties.
Iregi Mwenja, the head of Kenya Psychiatric Disability Organization, was the organizer of the two-day mental health event.
A lot of those trauma end up piling up, and it can be really psychologically distressing. So we decided that we will come here and have a day of expressive therapy, debriefing, art therapy, bonding, and having fun and games. You know, it was a day to make the health workers feel like they are loved and appreciated.
Latest figures from the Johns Hopkins University, which is tracking cases globally, indicate that Kenya currently has more than 36,000 confirmed coronavirus cases and 622 deaths. Mohammed Yusuf for VOA News, Nairobi.
And that's it for this Tuesday, September 15th edition of Daybreak Africa. On behalf of the Daybreak Africa crew, producer Nicole Beckford, reporters Peter Clotty and Reiki Shryak, as well as sports editor Samson O'Malley, along with all of our engineers, I'm James Barty in Washington, wishing you a very good day.
VOA brings you the best in African music on the African beat. African Beat showcases the latest and the greatest of contemporary African music, from bubu music to hip life, bongo flavor to sukus, Afrobeat to Ndumbulu and Makosa to Kwaito. The African Beat on VOA has it all. And it's happening right here, Mondays through Fridays at 09:05 and 20:05 UTC, right after the international news.